session number 248991.
Cecily Mackworth, Reel 1. Can you tell me if there was a tradition of military service in your family background?
Yes, very much so. I think they've always been soldiers in my... The Mackworths have always been soldiers, I think, as far as I know.
And what did their ladies do, generally?
Oh, I suppose they sat at home and embroidered. Some of them were French. My grandmother, my great-grandmother anyway, was Julie de Richepons, and there were one or two French people scattered around in my background.
Did your parents or other members of your family talk to you at all about the First World War?
Oh yes, the whole time, because my father was killed, but I never knew him. Mm. He was killed right at the beginning. And of course, everything was his medals were everywhere, his this and that. And it was a great thing in my life. Mm-hmm. And when I was 4, I think I was asked what I'd like for a birthday present, and I said a portrait of Lord Kitchener.
Do you remember what regiment or corps your father was in?
I can't remember from here. He was doing something. I think he was a gunner. But he'd come from the Staff College. Mm. I don't quite know what it is. Mm.
Do you remember what your family said to you in general terms about the Great War? What do you remember of it?
Well, yes. You see, it was a very heroic time when England gave her finest sons and all that sort of thing. Mm. And now I've rather changed my mind about all that. About war in general, and but there I was tremendously enthusiastic, you know, military. And when my mother married again a man who'd somehow got out of going to the war, that was absolutely, I was furious, and I hated the man with all my heart. It was beastly to him, put me.
You were growing up between the wars.
Yeah.
Do you remember if at any stage you thought there is bound to be another war in Europe?
No.
You didn't?
No. Mm-hmm. I don't think people did. Well, of course, by 1930, we were beginning to be... I don't know, I think we were beginning to get a little bit nervous about Hitler, perhaps, yeah. But not very seriously. Mm. No, my adolescence was war-free.
Mm. What about your young adulthood? I think you were in Central Europe, weren't you?
I was in Central Europe for a bit. The thing is that I was absolutely impossible at home. They couldn't bear me. And so I think my Aunt Margaret Ronda was alerted. And she was held here. I stayed in this women's hostel as a girl and started writing. And she gave me some money to travel. And I went out to Hungary, which at that time was very, very popular. You know, England was very popular in Hungary. Mm. And they wanted at one moment to give the crown of Saint Etienne to Lord, who was it? Lord, one of Lord somebody, anyway, an England Englishman, a newspaper owner, I think.
Lord Northcliffe?
No, it wasn't Lord Northcliffe, it was another Lord.
Harmsworth?
I can't remember, but I'm sure anybody would. Mm. No, I can't remember who it was. But anyway, there was talk of giving the crown of St. Etienne to this Englishman. Of course, it never came off, naturally. But the English were very, very popular. And the status symbol at that time was to have an English girl of good family to live with you and talk to the girls in the family.
What did you make of the atmosphere in Hungary when you got there?
Well, I was too young. I missed the whole experience, really. It was still in the feudal days. And I was already rather shocked by the attitude of the peasants, who really lived, you know, sleeping the whole family on one sand floor. And they exploited their peasantry horribly. Mm. Made them pay for flowers to put on the graves of their...
You were saying the peasants in Hungary were very badly treated.
Yeah, I thought so, yes. Mm. Very. And I was too young to sort of get into things at all. And I didn't get on with the people.
What was wrong with the people?
Well, they were... it's difficult to say. They were sort of very minor aristocracy. And I thought they'd never thought about any such things when I said to them. But what they did have, they had very good horses. Mm. And they gave me horses, so I used to ride away and enjoy myself like anything.
Where did you go after you got fed up with Hungary? What happened?
I came back to England. Mm. And I was, of course, in the throes of a love affair. This was rather connected. And where it was going badly, and I wanted to escape from it. So I went to Berlin. And I had a friend who was out there. And she suggested that I come out, join her, and live there by giving English lessons.
What year was that?
Which year was the Reichstag burnt?
34, perhaps. Perhaps later.
No, it couldn't have been later, I think.
32, 33?
Yes, it was about that time. Mm. And I went out there, but I hadn't given her any notice. I was a little scatterbrained at that time. And she was just leaving to join her father somewhere in Russia, I think. Mm. He was a journalist. And I found myself completely alone, without a word of German, and no money. But I got myself a job with a nice little Jewish widow, and I looked after her little boy. And it was very exciting, because it was the time when the Nazis and the communists were clashing like mad, and you had to be one or the other. Mm-hmm. So I thought the Nazis were horrible. The big swaggering red blondes, and so I decided I'd be a communist. So I used to go in processions in front of Dmitri's prison and shout "Raus, Raus!"
Did you get involved in any violent demonstrations or street fighting?
No, I didn't. But I watched them. Mm. I saw a great deal of violence and heard it. Mm. I heard it all going on. I heard Hitler, but didn't see him. And it was all piling up to become... it was a pity that I wasn't a little bit older and more politically inclined. I could have seen Europe moving out of the old Pacific Europe into the new land.
You were a young English woman with an aristocratic background. How did the communists take to you when you...
Oh, they didn't. I didn't know them.
Oh, you didn't know them?
No, not really. Mm. No, they just used to say, English. No, I didn't have any real connection with them at all.
You didn't join the party?
No. I just decided I'd be a communist because I didn't like the Nazis.
Mm. How long did you stay in Berlin?
5 months.
Ah. What happened to you after that?
I went back to London and I spoke very good German at the end of 5 months. I took a course at the university for foreigners and I had fluent German, so I went back and I did some translating and got little odd jobs. I hooked electric appliances in the London suburbs and tried to earn my living. And that's it. I got married during this time.
In London?
No, I was in Belgium. Oh. I married a Belgian. And he was a poor man. I knew he was ill, but we thought he was really cured. Oh. And then he had a crisis of tuberculosis and died, leaving me with a little baby. So I stayed for a short time with my in-laws in Brussels, and then I went back to London, because then the war came, that's right, which was the war, and I had to get back to England. And I think that was really what rather saved me, having the war on. It made me be more sensible, I think.
So were you in England at the outbreak of war? Or in Belgium?
No, I was in... No, the war had started.
Do you remember if the outbreak of the war was a great shock to you? Or was it something you...
No, I think we'd seen it. Once I was in Berlin, all the same, even I could see that there was... It was on the... It was threatening, you know. No, I think it didn't come as a surprise at all. But I forget how I got back. But it was fairly easy at that time, and it still could come and go. So I got there.
You got back to London?
Got back to London.
I think you were in... Weren't you in Paris in 1940? How did you end up being in Paris in 1940?
With my Belgian in-laws, when my husband died, I went to Paris with my child.
Yes.
Because... I think for no special reason, really. I loved Paris, and I wanted to be there. And I didn't realize yet. I wanted to see what was going to happen. I wanted to be in Europe and to see see things coming to a head. And there was already a lot of trouble in France. I think we realized, and they were. I think it was at that time, about that time, that De Gaulle left for England.
What sort of trouble in France?
Well, we were very badly led. There was, I think it was Gamelin.
He was the chief of staff.
Yes, I think so. And hopeless leaders, political quarrelling the whole time, the right and the left. A lot of anti-Semitism. I went there. Stayed there till 1944, till the war was going, and then if I'd had any sense, I'd have gone straight back to London. But I wanted absolutely to see what was going to happen, and I couldn't believe that the French were simply going to give up. I thought they'd fight back from, first of all, the government went to Bordeaux, and after that, I thought they were bound to retreat to Algiers. And I wanted to see what was going to happen, that was all.
Were you in Paris before the mobile operations began? They began on the 13th of May.
Yes, I'd been there for a couple of years. I couldn't stand living with my farm, with my in-laws.
Yes.
And I went back to, Paris, where I had a little flat.
What was the atmosphere in Paris before the 13th of May, before the 10th of May?
Very full of suspicion. Nobody could understand why I was there, what I was doing. I think I was generally taken for a spy.
What were you doing?
Well, nothing very much. I was until things began to really hot up. And then I met somebody who was in the Red Cross and said, can you give me something to do? And they gave me some little job doing nothing in the Red Cross. And then it was at that moment that King Leopold...
Yes.
Gave up. And the Belgians came flooding into Paris. And there were no trains out.
Just trains in.
Just trains in. And I went to the guard, those Stelliots, and found that the other semi-nurses who'd been working with me had all been recalled to Bordeaux. And they'd forgotten about me. I was just there. And so I had to... I think that was the really difficult time when there was nobody to rely on nobody to tell you to do this or that. Mm. You were completely abandoned to yourself. The only thing you could do was to have a few ideas and keep to them.
Once the mobile operations began, 10th of May, that was, do you remember whether or not you were able to keep a rough picture in your mind of what was actually going on, or did you have any...
Nobody knew anything.
You had
we knew that the Belgians had been... the Germans had overrun Belgium. That the Belgians had flocked out of Belgium. And... were going anywhere, the whole of Europe, was going somewhere without knowing where. And they were there and they were locked in trains. They weren't allowed to go out of the station. The trains weren't leaving. And they couldn't go either in or out, so there were very ugly scenes when they were trying to break down the bars of the station or break the trains so as to crowd out. And I and a few other people there, I met a few of my friends who were also down there, and we doled out barrels of water so at least they could have something to drink.
Were there any official measures to try and relieve the distress of the refugees?
Not that I saw.
How did the atmosphere in Paris change then when things started to happen rapidly? Because there had been the long period of drôle de guerre when
yes,
you said
exactly.
People were suspicious of you.
Well, it was just sudden panic. There was nobody to be suspicious of. Everybody just streamed out of the place. And they didn't even know where they were going. They were just leaving. And there was nothing to eat. All the shops had been cleaned out.
When did you actually set off? And where did you think you were going when you
did? Well, I had rather regularly, I had friends who... I thought of going there, I thought I'd either go back to England or go join the people in Bordeaux. The government had gone to Bordeaux. And I thought I could do one or the other. And one of my friends bought for practically nothing a broken down car, two-seater, and we were five people in it. And we set off. First of all, there were a certain number of broken down cars, and and we were going to this friend of mine had his wife and baby in Rennes, so we headed for Rennes, and we knew the English also were passing by there, and when the car broke down very quickly. There was a lot of tremendous propaganda. There were stories going through all the crowds of what the Germans did, and that they were here, there, and everywhere. The disinformation carried to its peak.
Were you able to keep the car going along the roads?
No, only just at first.
Yes.
Just at first. And then it broke down and we were left there stranded, and then we got it, somebody managed to mend it a little bit further. But anyway, eventually we arrived in Rennes.
Had you seen any British troops on the road?
No, but I saw them in Rennes.
What were they doing?
They were retreating for England. And there were a great many of them. And what I noticed was that there were Irish troops, there were many of them with sort of funny green berries.
The Peban.
Yes.
And the green hackle.
Yes, all that.
Do you remember, did you speak to them at all?
Yes, quite a lot.
What sort of things did they tell you?
They didn't know. It's almost the same. They just didn't know what was happening. But they knew they were making roughly for, what was it they were making for? Yes, they were anyway for Brittany, I think it was, to cross to England. And one of them was a charming officer who had a Bentley, and he gave it to me, just like that. Now take it, I can't use it anyhow. electricity, and there's no petrol. Mm. But I hadn't got it, and I couldn't drive anyway, so I had to say no, I didn't want his pension.
Were you still with your friends at that stage?
No, it was at Wren that they took that they had to join my friend's wife's mother. And they went off to stay with her, and then we planned to meet at Aubusson and see what was going to happen in there.
What was the physical and mental condition of these British soldiers when you saw them?
Difficult to say. They looked pretty ordinary. There wasn't any great defeatism or anything special. They were orderly. They were marching off or straggling off, bewildered. They didn't know what was happening, but they were, the British thing was going on.
So they were in proper.
You can't say they were quite in proper order, but they were more or less, they were all going roughly in the same direction, and they did have officers with them. Mm. And
did they have their weapons?
Yes, I think. I'm not sure about that. I think they had their weapons all right. I think some of them, I don't know if there were those who'd come from Dunkirk or went straight back. That was later anyway. There was nothing very special, but there were an awful lot of them. And they were all leaving from this Breton port.
And they were moving in a reasonable
quite
manner.
In an orderly way.
Yes.
Well,
how did you get down to Aubusson?
Yes, and that it was in Rennes. They bombed Rennes. When these soldiers were, that's right, all these soldiers were passing through Rennes, the German planes landed this.
You were saying that you were bombed while you were at Rennes.
We were bombed. Mm. Well, not while I was there. Well, my friends had gone away. I was alone in Rennes. Mm. I put my things down at the station. It was very, very hot at that time, sizzling weather. Mm. And I went somewhere to get a drink, and the bombs came down and demolished the station, and with it my suitcase, papers and everything else.
Was that the first time you'd been under air attack?
Yes.
How far away were you when this bombing took place?
It's not, I wasn't very conscious of it at the time it happened, so I think it was the station, and I suppose I'd gone off somewhere and was inside somewhere having a cold lemon or something of that sort. And so after that, then in some way or other, all the refugees were rounded up. I haven't very much memory of that. And we were put into a convoy and sent off for Chartres.
Was this a road convoy?
This was a road convoy.
Were you in motor vehicles of any sort?
There were occasionally broken down. But there were just occasional cars, but I hadn't got one. Mm. I was on foot. Mm. And there were the like a scene on the cinema. When palm wagons, everything you could imagine, bicycles, anything loaded on.
Who had actually done this organising of the convoy and pointing you towards Chartres?
Mystery. Mystery. Mm. Who did anything? I never knew. I just knew that I'd been pushed into a convoy. Mm. And I'd still got my nurse's uniform, which was very dirty by then. And we started, we just trudged. And somebody started occasionally at the beginning, move on, and there was no news. That was really the hard part, nobody to tell you to do anything.
Had you received any training in nursing or
Absolutely
first
not.
Aid?
None whatever.
Were you ever called upon to act in a nursing or first aid capacity?
Yes, I was. I think I did tell you that, people... the German Stukas knew that we were in this convoy, and they were coming down diving and bombing us with the little planes. And so when we heard a plane diving towards us. We threw ourselves into the ditches, one on top of the other. And then I did have to, because people saw that I was wearing a nurse's uniform, and so they thought I was a nurse and called to for me. And I knew there was nothing I could do, but there was one man, I think I killed him, didn't I? Who was, her face was quite purple and looked as though he couldn't breathe. So I thought perhaps I couldn't think of what I, everybody said, nurse, come. Didn't know what to do. So I got a penknife and I think some odicolone or something to sterilize it. And then I took his ear like that and turned away, but I didn't see the blood and cut it out.
Did he respond to that treatment at all?
I don't know, because I couldn't see. We were just, along. Usually we weren't allowed to.
You just had to move on again.
Well, everybody, it wasn't even that you weren't allowed to. It just was the force of movement.
But you were pressed forward. You were physically pressed forward.
Yes.
What happened at night when you were doing this move towards Chartres?
Night and day, I think we just fell into the ditches and went to sleep. I haven't much memory of exactly how that happened. I know there was no food.
Was there any water? Were you able to get fluids?
Well, from time to time there were people on the bank who would come down with a little water and supply us a little bit. And some of them, which made me very, very angry, charged for their water. That really was the thing. But most of them just came down and gave it. And some people, I suppose, had food with them. I hadn't any.
Did you reach Chartres?
No.
Ah.
We weren't meant to. We weren't allowed to reach Chartres. But we, from where was it? Yes, but there were a lot of demobilized French soldiers were streaming out, had been mobilized in Chartres. And they were coming out very angry. And their officers simply told them, "We can't do anything more for you, just get out and try to get home."
Did you speak to them at all?
Yes, I did.
What did they say to you? What sort of things did they say?
They said they'd been betrayed by their officers. But they said it wasn't the same everywhere. But as far as in their own personal experience, they felt that they had been betrayed. Their officers had said simply, "Get out, try to get home." And they'd been there. They showed me. One of them showed me his rifle. It was an 1870 model from that old war. And they were quite voluble about all that. And some of them said that France must go on and try to hold out. And others said no. The only thing to do was to give up and to try to get to their homes as far as they could.
Would you say that the ones you wanted to fight on were more numerous than the others, as far as you could tell, or was it the other way around?
No, I think on the whole list, they were very demoralised at that time.
So the defeatists were...
I should say there were more, yes.
Yeah, more numerous,
say,
the ones you met,
on
anyway.
Try to
let
the Boche get us entirely.
What did you think of that? Did you think that France could have continued fighting, or did you think that the game was up?
Well, I refused to think the game was up. I thought that it would be all right. I wanted to think. And after that, what happened? And then I think again in the same convoy, or more or less, we got to Le Mans. Where again it was a lot of these demobilized soldiers. And there were also the English regiments there passing through to embark at Brest.
So they'd have been going in the other direction then, wouldn't they?
I suppose they came up from the south. I don't quite see why they were there.
Well, what sort of troops were they? You said the ones you'd seen earlier at Rennes were Irish.
Well, I saw one or two Irish. They may not have been all Irish. And these were no... I was in no state by then to look at their badges. And I hadn't had anything to eat, for goodness sakes, when I was...
And what condition were they in? You said the ones earlier had looked... ordinary,
well,
but...
I think the French were much more orderly. They were encadrés by their officers, you see. It was a different sort of thing there. They weren't just loosed out.
Yes. But the second lot of British ones you saw at the man, what state were they in? Were they still under control?
Yes, they were under control.
Mm.
No, the French.
Session number 24899, Reel 2.
Sesame Mackworth, Reel 2.
Yeah.
So you were saying that the British troops were under control. The French troops were effectively stragglers trying to find their way home.
Yes, that's about the situation. Mm-hmm. And of course, on this flat country, the plain of Beauce, something like that, there was no shelter at all. Mm-hmm. Nowhere to go, really. They mm-hmm. just had to hope for the best and try to go to people and the people in farms and so on.
Coming under air attack, you were short of sleep, you've been moving. Did you get frightened during that long journey?
Well, I'd written quite a bit about my state, and I was really so... I was in the state that I was really half-conscious.
Oh.
No sleep and no food, I think it was 3 days, and no food at all. Mm-hmm. And the only food that I did get for quite a long time was either chocolate or strawberries. Oh. The two staple diet. and it isn't very, very nourishing either. And what happened then was that Ethrin, I found myself therefore alone without people, without money, and my luggage bombarded. So I thought I must try to get to there. I couldn't get back to England from there, or not immediately. I thought I'd try to get to Nantes, because there was a consul, there was a British consul there. I thought I'd try to get down there. And I found a train at last, which hardly moved, just like a little bit occasionally. And there was a Polish regiment going on there too. And it was so crowded that these poor Poles were strung along on the side steps and tied onto the door handles.
Outside the train?
Fall off.
Outside the train?
Yeah.
And were you able to talk to them? Did they say what they were doing?
No, I couldn't. I was absolutely just crushed. Unable to move.
Presumably they were in French service, these
Poles. Yes, those people I spoke. Yes, they were Polish regiments, And they were there. And then at last I got to Nantes in this way, but very long time. And there was a consul who was totally inefficient, who said, don't come bothering me, I can't do anything for anyone. All I want is to get away, go away, go away. So I got out of court. And the consuls were very, very bad, I may tell you, everywhere in there. Even in Spain.
Was this, had France capitulated by this stage?
While I was there, but in Rennes, that I heard that Pétain had been appointed, and we saw pictures of him.
What did you think about that? Because he was a great hero of the First War, wasn't he?
I didn't know really much about him, but I knew he'd been a great hero of the First World War. Of course, I'd heard all about Verdun and all that. And he was, we saw pictures of him. I was quite prepared to admire him, but he was very, very old and senile looking, poor old thing, you know. And I thought, what can he do anyway? One couldn't get any news. I didn't know what he was going to. What it was going to be. And I think it was at that time that De Gaulle. Another nice looking boy of about 18 or 19 picked me up in a car, and I said I wanted to go in that direction.
Which direction was he heading in then?
He was also heading down there. He was a fascist. He belonged to one of these groups, you know, that had to go, but I think they were.
And you mean down there towards
Poitiers?
Out towards Poitiers, yes.
And Aubusson, which I wanted to go to.
Did you get to Aubusson eventually?
I did, yes. I got to Aubusson. And I met there Jean Lursa, who's a man, he became very famous for doing tapestries. He revived the tapestry industry in France.
And were your friends there? Because you had made you'd arranged to meet them there, hadn't you?
Yes, I never did meet them.
And had they been there or moved on, or did you not discover what had happened?
I never discovered quite what had happened. No, but I did meet Jean Lursa, who was leaving also, but who said I could have his flat while I was there. So then I moved into a comfortable flat and had some sleep. Very nice.
How long did you need to actually recover from your journey up to that point then? You know, if you needed
after
sleep and so forth?
Well, I was young, no one discovered and one recovers fairly quickly. I think, but it was there that I created a necessary dispensary.
How did you do that?
Well, there were floods of English soldiers coming down there. Completely, they were completely disorganised, unlike all the other troops that I'd known. They didn't know where they were. They hadn't the faintest idea where they were, and they thought vaguely that they were heading for North Africa. And so I could talk to them, and they said they just didn't know anything. All they wanted to know what was happening, were we beaten, where were the Germans, what were the Germans doing. Total désarroi. The English, when they become désarroi, are very much so.
Were you able to tell them anything?
Very little. Well, I could tell them where they were.
You are an Aubusson.
Yes, they were in Aubusson, which I'd never heard of. But I could show them where Aubusson roughly was on the map. And then all I could say was that I'd heard that the Germans were advancing, but I didn't know where to or what was happening. And there, a lot of these boys were wounded.
Oh.
Whatever I could do, I took a room in the schoolhouse and tried to roughly bandage people up. It was quite easy to bandage somebody, really. You don't need any special training.
Were these walking wounded then?
Oh, yes, these were walking wounded. At least all the ones I saw were. I don't know if there were others.
Did they have any medical orderlies with them? Or?
No, they didn't seem to have anything with them. There was one officer who also didn't know any more than his men, really. But he said that he thought that they were being directed to North Africa.
Do you know what regiment or they were from?
No idea. I think they hardly knew themselves. And so I did quite a lot of it down there. I enjoyed that very much. And I went down, rifled the chemist's shop and took everything.
What did the chemist think about that?
People didn't think of anything, that anything might happen anywhere. It was so disorderly. Such chaos everywhere. Nobody was surprised that anything would happen. But it was there, staying with the Ursaars. They had an old wireless machine. And we weren't allowed, all the news from all the French news was censored, which was ridiculous, really, because the French collaborated more or less with the censorship and made things even worse. And so it was there that I heard the girl. There was a lot of crackling and instruments, and then we couldn't get anything. And then suddenly we did hear a voice saying, there's been a... we've had a defeat, but not the French. But there's no war. We done it.
So De Gaulle was saying that a battle had been lost, but
yes, nous avons une défaite, mais nous n'avons pas perdu la guerre. And so, because that absolutely thrilled me, and so I wanted immediately to get back to England. I'd been rather uncertain as to what I should do. Whether perhaps I should try to get to North Africa and have my other children with a child there.
What impact did this broadcast have on your French friends?
They were very, very thrilled on the whole. They didn't understand, and they didn't understand what was going to come out of it, and that De Gaulle would be considered a traitor. And I think especially not among the Lursas perhaps, but I made a few bourgeois friends there. And I think that they were... At the beginning, it was all right. I think they would have said he was a traitor, not to the army, to his officers.
Because he'd run away to England.
Yes, and was taking on an attitude which was inadmissible.
You were saying that earlier on you had a lift with a young man who was a fascist, a French
fascist. Yes, and he was very bewildered. He didn't know what he ought to think.
Yes.
He said that he was all for, that he was all for resisting. At the same time, he couldn't really admit that an officer should disobey his commander-in-chief and set up as a commander on his own in England, and also a fight with the English against the French to some extent.
So there's a conflict between patriotism on the one hand and respect for authority on the other.
Very much so. And one found that all the time. But after that, after the time I got back to England, that from what all my people I met afterwards when I came back to France, it was like that all the time. Mm. And even now, I sometimes have arguments with friends.
About what the right course of action was.
Yes, what the right course of action was, and whether the girl was justified in doing that.
Mm. It's not the kind of argument you find particularly amongst English people, is it? That sort of philosophical dilemma is not
so... Would we have had it, perhaps, that needs some waiting a little bit longer. Perhaps if the Germans had arrived in England, and when you saw that film to the with the butler, wonderful film.
Yes, The Remains of the Day.
Remains of the Day,
yes.
And I wonder, there are an awful lot of people like that, I think.
Yes.
So, I don't know, what do you think? Do you think there would have been arguments of that same sort? You see, Churchill would have been kicked out, and somebody, an extreme right, would have been put in.
Well, they were.
So collaborate with the Germans, you know, they are really there.
Well, after Dunkirk, there were some members of the cabinet and the government who were in favour of negotiation, in particular.
Exactly.
Lord Halifax was, and R.A. Butler.
Yes.
Were inclined to think that the war had been lost and it would be sensible to compromise.
Yes.
But I was thinking about this idea of the conflict between patriotism on the one hand and the duty to obey superiors on the other.
Well, I think we should have had the same little dilemma, don't you? You see, there's somebody would have been chief under the Germans, would have been the chief of the Prime Minister, whatever they were, and that also have been, I presume, people who would have resisted.
It's simply that I think in France there is more of a philosophical approach to life in general.
Yes, it's quite true, there is much more.
There's a stronger tradition of authoritarianism.
Yes.
Whereas in England there's a stronger tradition of ignoring authority if they seem to have got it wrong, according to your instinctive judgment.
Yes, I suppose that is so. It has been very disappointing we weren't able to see what would have happened.
Indeed. Well, we can't run through the history again.
I think you'd better do that, Mike.
How long did you stay in Aubusson, roughly?
Oh, a few days. Mm. It was always I never stayed anywhere more than a few days. But still, I got a rest. I was more human when I left. Mm. And
you, once you heard the goal, you had a definite objective, didn't you?
Yes,
to England.
I'd been swimming along, not knowing where I was going all
drifting,
the
time. Drifting, effectively.
Drifting, absolutely, yes. Mm. And I knew that I really must be able to get back to England and join the girl. Mm.
And did you have any idea of the best way to do that?
Well, there was. I knew that one might get to Bordeaux, but there was such news as we had that it was very, very difficult. And that there's quite soon there'd be no more boats going back to England at all. Mm. But I thought I wouldn't try it. It was very difficult anyhow to get to Bordeaux. So I went south, taking trains, which is slightly better than I don't know if you could travel. And I went to... I got as far as Marseille.
How are you going on for money at that stage, then? Because you lost your money at the Rennes, hadn't you?
What I want to say is that I knew that my brother-in-law was in Rocamadour.
Ah.
He'd come from Belgium. I don't know how I knew that. I did know that he was there. Mm. And at one point I got up to a lock on my door. There were a whole lot of people who come with the Belgian exodus.
The refugees.
Mm. And there were a lot of them there, all distraught because they didn't know where their families were.
Mm.
And so he gave me some money. Not very much, but he had some. And then I went by in Toulouse, where the news of Mers El Kabir had just come through.
What did you think when you heard that?
Well, I was horrified. I just couldn't think why they'd done it. I had explanations later when I went back to London, and I was told more or less why and how.
Mm. And what did your what did the French think in the area around?
They were absolutely furiously anti-British. Because by then all the rumours had got around, and all the propaganda, the anti-British propaganda, had become naturally absolutely violent. And they were, I said I was Belgian, but I'd got Belgian papers as well as English at that time.
You're saying that the French people around Toulouse were terribly anti-British. And
terribly anti-British.
You were able to regard yourself as a Belgian or present yourself as a Belgian.
Yes, because I've got an accent, a strong British accent, so I couldn't pretend to be French at any point.
Mm. But you might pass for a Belgian.
Yes, I could pass for a Belgian. And that was all right. It was rather unpleasant, you know, to hear this tremendous hatred of the British, which was being stirred up, of course, by French propaganda, by the at the same time.
Was this propaganda coming down from the Vichy?
Yes.
Mm.
Oh, yes. In great force.
Mm.
And then after that, I got to Marseille, where I saw German soldiers for the first time, in all of Pigeon. I'd never seen a German.
Mm.
And there they were. They came down and did a raffle. Scooped people up. But I didn't know why. There was suddenly the streets were full of Germans. And nobody knows that, the German presence of one at one point in Marseille.
Well, do you know what they were doing there? Did you?
Yes, they were presumably looking for people for the resistance, because most of the resistance had been concentrated by then in the south, and I think they were large for that.
What impression did you get of them when you first saw them?
I didn't wait to see them. Mm. There was a cafe, and I rushed downstairs, the downstairs loos, and I sort of slipped into a loo and locked myself in, and they didn't even come. I just saw the Germans in uniform, rushing up the streets and picking people up.
Mm. And do you know when that was? What month?
Well, it was August.
August of 1940?
Yes. Mm. And it was very, very hot. There was spectacular heat right through those months.
You've got to Marseille. What was your plan? Was it to...
My plan was to get to Spain.
Get to Spain.
Yes. Mm. And I did get to Spain with a great difficulty. I had to climb a rather horrid mountain all on my own, but not a very high one. You see, I could get through... There were duans, and they wouldn't let you through at all. The passage was locked entirely. You couldn't go to Spain. But a lot of people did. And I did. I went off on my own. Climbed. And
how did you know the route? Did you have a map?
No. Mm. No, I thought it was fairly obvious. There was a sort of goat track. That was pointing in the direction of Spain. I should be able to get there. And that's what I did. I got down into Spain.
What happened to you when you got onto the Spanish side?
That was by no means the end of things. It was a time when they'd been having the Civil War. It was just after the Civil War. And they were all... There'd be terrible slaughter and misery there. There were a lot of officers going around in uniform. All one arm and one leg. And there was a blackout. It was night. I didn't speak Spanish. There was and I didn't know what to do. So I thought the only thing to do was just try and see what happens. And nothing much worse can happen now. And so there was officers fighting past in the dark. And I just went up to him and said, look, don't misunderstand me, but I don't speak Spanish, I haven't any money, I've just arrived, I don't know what to do. Could you possibly tell me of some decent little place where I could spend the night and have a rest? And he said, yes, I live in such a place, if you like, I can take you with me and recommend me to you.
What language were you speaking to him? Were you speaking English?
Yes, I'd asked him. The first thing I said was, est-ce que parle l'anglais ou le français? Mm. And I forget which he did speak, English, I think. And so he took me, and I stayed in this pension for several days. But it was crowded with horrible young men who turned out quite soon to be Germans and Nazis. Mm. And after being rather nice to me at the beginning, they very soon twigged that I was British and got on the road and became very unpleasant. Mm. Now, I think I told you that, but perhaps I said it in French and you didn't know that. Mm. I don't recollect this. And one of them said to me, well, it's been nice meeting you anyway, I've enjoyed speaking English. And when I come to England, when we get to England, I'll come and call on you. So I was very romantic. I said, but I have still my father's sword, and I shall be waiting. And imagine.
Which part of Spain was this then that you'd got?
This was in Madrid.
Oh, in Madrid.
Yes. Mm. And then I was in my room, but the serving maid burst in, threw her arms on my neck, burst into tears, and said, go away at once, get away, because they're all Nazis, and they're going to have you arrested. Mm. So I disappeared without paying. Yeah. Mm. I was awful British.
Had you made contact with the British consul?
I did. I went to the British consul, and he did give me just a little money to take me to Lisbon. Mm. And I got a train there. Arrived in Lisbon.
Were there any controls on the Spanish-Portuguese border?
I don't think there were. I don't remember any. And they fed me. People were very kind and gave me garlicky sausages and things to eat on the way. And when I got to Berna, I went to the consul. It was much nicer than the others had been. But he also apparently couldn't quite understand what I was doing there. But he did in the end give me a little money. Every day we had to queue up, the refugees used to queue. Mm. He'd hand out so many escudos. And I stayed there, and then in the end I took this Japanese ship, I told you.
How did you prove to him that you were bona fide British then? Because you had Belgian papers.
Yes, well, that's what he said. Mm. He said, yes, but how do I know who you are? And I saw he got a copy of the Brits. And so I said, well, you look there, you'll find me. And so that was a very great advantage. The system says...
Social.
And that's what I did, and then I got back.
Mm. And you were saying you got on a Japanese ship. Mm. But were there no British ships available? Because Portugal was neutral, wasn't it, at that time?
Oh, no, there was no British ship. Mm. Gone there, but Lisbon was very neutral, you know. Mm. And all the spies of Europe of every kind were there. You know.
How did the Japanese react to you when you took passage on their vessel?
Well, they were very polite, as you can imagine, and it was very comfortable, I think, I suppose. And we lay out in chaise longue, and once a day, one of the little Japanese officers would stride up the deck with a newspaper, reading aloud all the awful things that happened to the British. The British are in full defeat at here and there, and fleeing from the enemy. It's very loaded.
What about the rest of them? Did any of the others show any sign of...
No, very polite, very nice. Mm. And I had a very... I made friends there, and I thoroughly enjoyed my passage.
What happened when you got back to England then? Where did you come in to land?
We came in at Liverpool.
Ah.
And the first night there was the first bomb fell on Liverpool. And they rushed us all down, the hotel manager came, rushed us down to the cellars. And we had to wait there until the sound of the speakers was all clear. And then after that I went down to Somerset where my mother was at the time.
Oh.
And declared that I was alive, which she was very surprised to hear.
Were you given a prodigal son's
yes, I was
greeting when you returned?
Yes, yes.
Lost lamb returned to fold.
A little bit like, not much, my mother's wasn't that kind. But there were a lot, it's a retired place. It was a cinema for all places in the world. And yes, everybody was very excited, and we had a stream of visitors wanting to know, and especially wanting to know without having to ask me what had happened really, you know, what kind of adventures I'd had. And that I described one night and said how I had to sleep out in a field with four young French soldiers fleeing, and I didn't say the French, with four young soldiers, and the dear old colonel, you know, who was asking me about my adventures, and like I said, were they British? And no, they weren't. Well, I'm afraid I'm not much good at speaking, but.
So you were down in Sidmouth. I think you ended up going to London. How did that happen?
Took a train.
Ah. But did you have a purpose in mind or an appointment?
Oh, yes, of course. Mm. I was going straight to join the girl.
Ah.
Right away. Mm.
What happened when you got to the Free French headquarters?
Very unpleasant. I thought that we were all going to be a lot of heroes who retired there and were just saving France. But not a bit. There were a lot of very peculiar characters who'd arrived under obviously false names, and who they all seemed to have some. Didn't quite know what they were doing there, or what they really were, or what their opinions really were. And I stayed there for a bit. And I was sent there by MI5 or MI6.
When had you been contacted by MI5? Before or after you got?
After I got to London.
Yes.
But I stayed with them in London with a friend for a little bit first. Mm. And she was in the Foreign Office, so perhaps it was she who told. Anyway, they knew.
They knew about you?
Well, yes, because anyhow, landing in London like that, you know what it was like. You were very much interviewed and. They had to pass you as somebody who could be allowed to land.
Oh, I see. So you had to pass a vetting before you were...
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh,
what
yes.
sort of questions did they ask you during the vetting?
I don't think anything much. Mm. No, I don't think so. They just let me go down and do my...